So in the face of his enemies, he recommends love. In the face of oppression, he recommends forgiveness. In the face of violence, he recommends nonviolence. So the image of God that Jesus portrays is of nonviolence, of radical nonviolence, and of what you might call a weak power or the soft power of forgiveness, of love, not of aggression. Nonviolence is not passivity. It involves a very profound form of activity, because you expose yourself to, you put yourself in harm's way. I was on a panel one time with a bunch of Catholic theologians, including a well-known cardinal and the head chaplain of the Catholic chaplain in the of all the armed services, and I did armed services. I was the only one on the panel that thought that the Iraq War violated the conditions of just war theory. And it seemed to me, and they were all saying, well, the president knows more than we do, and he's got more information than we do. And he's saying, well, in that case, what do you have a just war theory for? I mean, you don't need anything, just trust the president.
Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall. Thank you so much for joining me today. I want to let you know that I brought back John Caputo today, and I really enjoy talking to him. He has been a theologian and a philosopher studying scripture and Christianity and religions for over 50 years. And it's in the context of traditional thinking of Christianity. And then he has expanded that notion in his field. He has really been cutting edge and on the edge of that field. Now, for a lot of people that listen to my show, it probably isn't that edgy for my show, because we will go into all sorts of different ideas of spirituality and what's really going on in history. And I'm not afraid to think about things from all different perspectives. We're all about paradigm change, innovation, disruption, looking at big issues that people might be afraid to even realize exists. And so for some of you that listen to this, this might not be that edgy for you, but he really is on the edge in his field. You know, and I grew up in a very Christian environment. Many of you probably don't realize that my mother was a Eucharistic minister. My father-in-law was a deacon in the Catholic Church. And so, you know, I grew up in a really Christian home, although we were pretty accepting and pretty different household. I know my father-in-law was a little bit more on the edge in a Catholic environment as well, but they're a little bit more traditional than probably most people in this country. And so I like diving into Christianity and looking at it in the confines of what it has been defined as, and then pushing that limit. And he is that person. And he's created the Weak Theology Movement. And I asked him what that is, and he explains what that is. And he also has this idea of the event and what the event is in Christianity. And it's really interesting, and it's really thoughtful, and gets you thinking a little bit different. And I do want to say that he comes at politics from a little bit different perspective than I do, and I love that. I think there's no problem. He is a Bernie Sanders supporter, which I hope we have a lot of listeners on this show that's was a Bernie Sanders supporter. I hope we can bring in people who view themselves on the right and people that view themselves on the left. As you all know, I think the left-right paradigm is a big farce anyways. I think when you get really good people who are well-meaning in there, who accepts everybody for who they are, but cares about our country first and does things that are disciplined and helpful for humanity first. I think when you have people like that together, we, even though maybe at the esoteric level you might not agree, I think you tend to agree at the basic level. And when you are going to be doing something and implementing something specifically, I think it's pretty surprising how much people tend to agree when you get rid of all the abstract stuff. And that's why I like bringing in people like John Caputo. So I also want to tell you that we did another segment for patrons only, because I really appreciate the patrons that support the show. And so for patrons only, there's going to be an additional content with him. Now I have a couple books up there and multiple videos now for patrons who support the program. So thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And let's get now into the interview with John Caputo. Hi, John. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here again.
Well, good. We had a lot of stuff that we didn't get to, so I really am glad you're coming back. And let's start with the biggest thing of all. What, you started the Weak Theology Movement. What is that? What does that mean?
Well, it's basically begins with a challenge to the classical idea of God as an omnipotent being. And the standard orthodox view of God is that God is an omnipotent, omniscient, omnibenevolent, all good being who transcends space and time. And I think that is, as one theologian put it, mythological and half blasphemous. And the reason I say this and some others say this is, first of all, it gets God into the middle of the problem of evil in a way that I just don't think you can extricate God from. Because once you say God's completely in control of everything, and you say that he knows what's best, and you say that he is good and desires what's best, you've set up an optimal set of conditions under which he should never let anything wrong happen, should never let innocent suffering, he would never let evil befall the innocent. And it's a very complicated discussion. It's been going on forever. It's as old as the Book of Job, right? So it's been going on forever, and nobody's ever really come up with any genuinely satisfactory solution, except to challenge this presuppositions, namely that that's the sort of being that God is. And I think it is the way that people have thought, that we've thought, humanity, West and East, but certainly Western humanity has thought about God. And I, that's what I want to challenge. The other thing that it gets you into is it pictures God as a judge who is going to reward and punish you for doing well or doing ill. And I think that undermines the intrinsic value of human activity. That is, you would treat children that way. You might threaten children with a timeout. When I was a kid, you threatened them with a little more than that. But nowadays, you threaten them with a timeout if they misbehave, and you reward them if they do behave. Now, that's a time-honored way of raising children. That's fine. But that's not a way to lead an adult life. It's not, you're subjecting adults to the conditions of childhood when you think of God like that, when you think of human life like that. If you think of it in terms of a system of rewards and punishments, if you think of it in strictly economic terms. So I say, For those reasons, for those philosophical and theological reasons, we have reason to doubt this image of God as a supreme, omnipotent, omnibenevolent, omniscient being. Second thing is, if you look at, in particular, at Christianity, what it says in the New Testament is that Jesus is the icon of God. That is, Jesus is the image. Paradigm. You're interested in paradigms and paradigm switches. Well, the New Testament provides an amazing and radical paradigm switch, because the image that The person who serves as an image of God is a crucified, publicly executed criminal who loses to the powers that be. He's humiliated. Crucifixion was not only a painful way to die, it was a humiliating way to die, because you were stripped naked and then left to hang on the cross and be until you were dead, and then they cut you down and let you the body be consumed by birds of prey, beasts of prey. So it was humiliating. So here you have this image, which is absolutely in striking contrast with all other images of God in antiquity, because the image of God in antiquity, and is persistent in Christianity despite the New Testament, is the image of a conqueror, a victor. And instead of someone who was defeated, abandoned by his disciples, and left to die on the cross, it's someone who, when he is arrested, tells the apostles to put down their sword, that that's not the way things are done in the kingdom of God. So in the face of his enemies, he recommends love. In the face of oppression, he recommends forgiveness. In the face of violence, he recommends nonviolence. So the image of God that Jesus portrays is of nonviolence, of radical nonviolence, and of what you might call a weak power, or the soft power of forgiveness, of love, not of aggression. So I say there are philosophical reasons for doubting this concept of God, but there are also very good reasons in the New Testament itself for thinking of God differently, radically differently, with what you might call powerless power, or weak power, or what I called the weakness of God, which was the title of the book. But that expression comes from St. Paul. It comes from the first chapter of 1 Corinthians, in which he's talking to a Greek city. He's speaking in Greek to Greek people. So there's a Greek aristocracy in this city, as there would be in any ancient city in the Roman Empire. There's a Greco-Roman aristocracy. And he's saying to them, you people are not well-born. You're not well-educated. You're nothings and nobodies as far as the world is concerned. And yet you have a wisdom which is greater than the wisdom of the world, which he calls the wisdom of the cross. So then he says, the weakness of God is greater than the strength of the world. God chose the weak to shame the strong. He chose the poor to shame the rich. And he chose those who are nothings and nobodies. He says in Greek, literally, ta me anta. You are nothings and nobodies as far as the world is concerned. And he chose you, nothings and nobodies, to shame the powers that be. Right? So he's using the language of being, which is the language of Greek philosophy. He's a smart guy, Paul. He knows what he's doing. He's a great rhetorician. So he chooses the language of Greek philosophy to say to the Greek aristocracy, the intellectuals in Corinth, that these people, whom you consider to be nothing and nobody, stand with God. God stands in solidarity with them. So for scriptural reasons and for philosophical, theological reasons, I think that the image of God in the that we have, the orthodox view of God that we have, is a mistake. And we need to radically rethink theology. We need to radically rethink the model of power and sovereignty that we've embraced. and think in the radical terms of peace, nonviolence, love, forgiveness, all of which Nietzsche would have called weak virtues rather than strong virtues. Strong virtues are aggression and courage. But the New Testament doesn't portray things like that. So that's where my idea of weak theology comes from. It's the expression of weakness of God is actually St. Paul.
Well, I have a question then. You know, when Jesus went into the temple and they, the money changers, and he got angry, how does that fit into weak theology?
Well, then you have a righteous indignation. You have what you call prophetic indignation. Now, he overturned tables. He didn't shoot anybody. He wasn't violent towards. There is one passage actually where he's violent towards animals, and so that causes the animal rights folks some trouble. You know, he drove a herd of swine over a cliff, according to the New Testament. But he, in that passage, in the famous passage of the overturning the tables of the money changers, it's a prophetic protest. Okay, so the prophets speak truth to power, and usually the result of that is they get killed. You know, there's a long history of prophets getting themselves killed because they speak truth to power, and Jesus belongs in that tradition.
So that's where being indignant but not violent makes a lot of sense, because there's a lot of things right now that we could get really indignant about.
Exactly. Yeah. So nonviolence is not passivity. It involves a very profound form of activity, because you expose yourself to you put yourself in harm's way. You know, Gandhi is very, very Christian, you know, or Martin Luther King. They are profoundly Christian examples of what I think Jesus would stand for. It was nonviolent activity, but it was very, very dangerous. And it was not passivity, it was activity. It was protesting, it was marching, it was exposing themselves to power in the strong sense. Now, I also think, by the way, that there's a political equivalent here. And I think what's a problem right now in the United States, and that is part of the power, greatness of the United States has been what it stood for. It's democracy, it's opportunity, its sense of equality, it's giving people a fair chance, allowing the freedoms of speech and assembly and religion, etc. It was a moral power that people admired. So it is what a political theorist named Joseph Nye calls soft power, as opposed to hard power. And I think that what's going on right now in the United States with all this nationalist rhetoric, and particularly Christian nationalist rhetoric, which is a square circle if you think about it, is undermining the deepest power of a democracy, of this nation, which was the soft power of a moral authority and of a place where people wanted to be like that, and they wanted to be here. And that, so there's a political equivalent here. There's something, this is not only a theological question or a question of private ethical life, it's also a political thing.
Well, I think a lot of the patriots believe that our taxes are going to evil, nefarious purposes, and that the politicians don't care about them. And so what they're trying to do is say, actually most of them don't want to go to war. They just want the politicians to stop lying and to care about the people of this country. I think that's the gist that I've gotten talking to most people in that circle. But I think they're very misunderstood. And of course, there's extremists on all ends. But I think the media has put them in a light that makes them look like they're something that they're not, based on what I have been observing.
Well, it depends on who you're talking about. If you're talking about Christian nationalists, the Christian nationalism of the right, then I think that is bad. It's bad scripture. It's bad theology. It's bad. It's bad political theory. I mean, the scriptures aren't political treatises. You know, they're not talking politics. They're giving us. They are really giving us paradigms. Your interest in paradigms, I think, rightly placed. They're giving us paradigms, and then it's up to us to figure out how these paradigms work, how they apply. I mean, you can't. Most of us have never even seen a fig tree, you know. But that's a very important parable in the scriptures. I mean, we didn't grow up in that place, and we don't. It takes years to figure out what the scriptures are talking about because it's talking about a place and a time which is quite distant from us. But one of the things that is the most prevalent, one of the most powerful themes in both the Jewish scriptures and the Christian scriptures is hospitality to the stranger, welcoming the foreigner, and knowing that that's risky business because, you know, when someone knocks on the door and you don't know who's on the other side, there's always a risk in opening the door. So nationalism is profoundly at odds with the biblical model of hospitality. And if you look at the scriptures, you count up. Well, you get out a piece of paper, draw a line down the middle, count up how many times it talks about sex and how many times it talks about the poor. It's, one of the interesting things about the New Testament is it practically never talks about sex. It shows very little interest in sex. When it mentions the family, it's usually to criticize it. Most of the references to the family are quite negative because and that reflects a debate that was going on in the New Testament. But it talks about the poor all the time. It's almost every other verse is about the poor and extending. And whenever the rich are mentioned, they're mentioned explicitly three times, and every time they're condemned. Now, you could say, well, they're only condemning the abuse of wealth. Well, you could say that, but the New Testament wouldn't be one of your sources for saying that. The New Testament simply condemns every time it thinks of mentioning the rich, it condemns them. When it thinks of the poor, it says that's what the kingdom of God is about. So the dynamics of the New Testament are, I'm maintaining, in the direction of what I'm calling weak theology. It's a dynamics of mercy, forgiveness, love, compassion, hospitality, openness to the other, not a dynamics of a sovereign power. And that was true. That held up for about three centuries in Christianity until Constantine. And as soon as Constantine became, the Christians were pacifists. The New Testament is a pacifist. There is the people who refuse to pay their taxes because they won't support they don't want to support an army, or have the New Testament on their side. Those of us who say, well, every once in a while you have to go to war, who invoke just war theory. Just war theory was unheard of before St. Augustine. It was unheard of before the time of Constantine. When the church finally got real power, real political power, all of a sudden it started thinking of all the good reasons for war, you know, and it comes up with the conditions of a just war. Now, you can look.
Well, not to interrupt you, but we have gone way past that in this country.
You're absolutely right. You said it. And the Christian community and the biblical community generally, I think, is negligent in failing to call us out on that. The notion of in this sign you will conquer, in hoc signo vinces, and they were referring to the cross, was coined in the time of Constantine when the church finally got real power. And then the cross, which is the symbol of an unjustly executed innocent man, becomes a symbol of power. the Crusades are, that comes from the word for cross, crux crucis. That the crusader is one who has a cross on his shield. Jesus, the only thing Jesus ever said about weapons was put them down. When he's arrested in the garden and the apostles go to pick up their sword to defend him, he says, put it down.
Well, let's look at something at context. Let's look at the fact that we have powerful people who are actively engaged in trafficking drugs and children and all sorts of things. How would it, according to what all your 50 years of research, how would Jesus deal with psychopaths who have a lot of power, who do awful things? How do you deal with that?
Yeah, you do what St. Augustine did. You start coming up with the conditions under which the ideals of the New Testament can be the least compromised. The Sermon on, someone once said, the Sermon on the Mount is the most compromised document in the history of the West. It holds up an ideal to us that is unrealizable as a in practice. What about self-defense? I mean, I think that Jesus's own example in the case of self-defense was to put down the sword. When you're talking about the lives and well-being of a modern nation state, which is something he never imagined. When he thought of a nation, a nation or an imperial power, he thought of Rome, and he thought of his own people as the victims of that kind of power. That's why I say the New Testament can only be a paradigm; it can't be a blueprint. It inspires you with certain ideals. And so the ideal we've come up with in the face of unavoidable nonsense, the violence, is to make it a last recourse, to exhaust every other means possible before we have recourse to it.
Before we use violence to keep them from doing violence against innocent others. Yeah. So you do everything first, and then if you can't do that, then you're forced to do violence, because otherwise there's a lot of violence to innocent people.
So the first condition of just war theory is last recourse. That's what happened with the great failure of the Catholic bishops and of the Christian community generally during the Iraq War was to fail to condemn it on the grounds that it was a blatant violation of the just war theory, because it was not a last recourse. It was a preemptive strike. And I was on a panel one time with a bunch of Catholic theologians, including a well-known cardinal, and the head chaplain of the Catholic chaplain of all the armed services, United Armed Services. I was the only one on the panel that thought that the Iraq War violated the conditions of just war theory. And it seemed to me, and they were all saying, well, the president knows more than we do, and he's got more information than we do. He's saying, well, in that case, what do you have a just war theory for? Well, you don't need anything. Just trust the president.
That's exactly right. Well, we have the same thing with ethical frameworks and all sorts of stuff. It's like we've thrown all that out the window.
Yeah. Yeah. So we've gone... The Western tradition has biblical sources. It's got a lot of sources. I mean, I don't mean to sound like the church lady, the old Saturday Night Live church lady. We've got a lot of sources of our tradition, one of which is the Greek philosophical tradition, and which led to modern science. And so we have a Greco modern scientific tradition of rationality and the Enlightenment, that dare to think of the Enlightenment. But we also have a biblical source. So the foundings, a good example of that would be the founding of the United States. It was founded by people who were children of the Enlightenment, who actually had a deistic notion of God, not a really good scriptural one. But they were also Christians. And so there was a dual source in the foundation of the United States. And so the Western tradition generally has symbolized under the figures of Athens and Jerusalem as the sort of symbolic cities or iconic cities which nourish our tradition. So we not only have these biblical models, but we also have the models of Greek philosophy and Greek science and scientific investigation, which began with the Greeks and then was taken up again in modernity and produced the West.
So would you say that we have a rich cultural tradition, but we've kind of lost our way a little bit? And it's almost like we need to rethink and, I don't know.
I would say I have never seen things worse than they are right now. I think that Christianity has, the Christian, contemporary American Christianity has gotten itself derailed on abortion and it has lost sight of the primary motifs of the New Testament. And I think what calls itself, a lot of what is calling itself Christian right now has nothing to do with the New Testament at all.
Well, as important as abortion is, because it is an important issue, we can't let it be one issue and then not look at the bigger picture of what we're trying to get accomplished.
Right.
Yeah.
If you actually read the Bible.
And it's coming from all sides, I think. I mean, I don't know, because I
think... Yeah, but Catholics and Protestants have gotten on that. I mean, I think, you know, abortion is profoundly... I never met anybody who thought it was a good idea, but... What you think is you want to make it, as Bill Clinton said, you want to make it safe, legal, and rare. And the way you make it rare is that you crack the problem of poverty. I mean, people, there's a direct proportion between unwanted pregnancies and abortions. And there's a direct proportion between poverty and unwanted pregnancies.
Yeah, but so, what do you think about cracking the problem of just no discipline? You know, because we're kind of in this free-for-all, decadent society where, because I know someone who wasn't poor who had three abortions. So it was hard for me to even hear her say that. But I think we have this kind of anything-goes decadent society. So I think we have both things going on.
Yeah. Yeah, we. I had a much more rigorous disciplinary upbringing when I was a kid. I grew up in a very Catholic neighborhood in a very Catholic family, and I went to Catholic schools. And you didn't mess, particularly in grade school. You did not mess with those nuns. I mean, they had me good and scared. And,
there was some value to that. Now, when we look back at that, right?
Yeah, as long as you get out of it. I mean, as my education went on, when I went to high school and then finally later on, I mean, I actually entered the Catholic religious order, so I had a very rigorous education. I went through Catholic schools until I graduated high school, then I went into a Catholic religious order for 4 years, and, I had plenty of discipline in my life.
Well, and I kind of really appreciate that. My mom's a Eucharistic minister. My father-in-law is a deacon in the Catholic Church. But what is so interesting is they're so open and they try to live, you know, my mother is Episcopalian. My father-in-law really struggled with what he saw in the Catholic Church because they didn't live the ideals of what you're talking about. But there's something to be said about strict discipline with yourself and not, you know, I mean, if you want to live the life of love and charity and things, you have to have a certain amount of self-discipline and then not overjudge other people as you go along.
Yeah. Yeah. The saints are tough. You know, when you look at the lives of the saints, they're really very rigorous, disciplined people. And, you know, there's an old joke, you probably heard this, but what's the difference between a saint and a martyr? And it said, a saint is a very holy person, and a martyr is someone who has to live with a saint. And, you know, the saints can be difficult. I mean, saints know what they want, and they're you can't talk them down from it. So they're tough. But their toughness is on behalf of others.
Exactly.
You know? So they're tough on themselves on behalf of others. So you're in you know, the model would be a kind of discipline. The other is first. The first will be last, and the last will be first. You can be tough on yourself and discipline yourself for the sake of others. And you put others first, you put the community first, you put the common good first. And then you have this sort of what's sometimes called the madness of the kingdom of God. You know, it's a kind of self-giving, self-sacrificing that ultimately in the long run makes for a richer and deeper life, but it's not self-seeking. If you seek yourself, you'll destroy yourself. If you serve others, you'll your own self will in the long run be enriched. So yeah, and that's it's just dissipating. It's just dissipating. So anyway, I pursue this kind of model of God, another way of thinking about God. But I pursue it rather far because I actually don't think anymore. I mean, my own position I finally got myself into after years of working with this stuff is I think the notion that God is a person somewhere who's in charge is a mythological idea. I don't think that God is a person like that. I think that God is, there's a Catholic theologian whom I like very much named Karl Rahner. And he uses the expression, I'm surprised the Vatican didn't get him for it because I think it's a very subversive expression. He uses the expression, the mystery we call God. So he puts the word mystery first. And then he says, our name for that mystery is God. And I think that gets it right. I think that's the way to do it, because I think what comes first is this notion of the deep mystery of our existence. And, you know, there was a philosopher named Leibniz who raised the question. It's a mind-boggling question. The question is, why is there something rather than nothing? Period. Why is there anything at all?
Rather I think than... that's a great question.
And, you know, you can't get your head around that. You know, there's no... the reality of the world is there before thinking arrives on the scene, and you're faced with this sort of proto-fact, this fact of all facts that the world is there. You say, well, God made it. And you say, well, why is there a God rather than not? That only puts the question back a step. Or if you're an atheist, you say, well, it's nature, it's natural necessity. And you say, well, why is there nature rather than that? Why is there this necessity called nature? It's like the Big Bang. It's like physicists. The interesting thing right now, I think, is that the physicists are becoming philosophers. You know, that what they're doing is so spectacular that they've gotten themselves into philosophy. And so they have this, you know, they've got pretty good account of the universe being 13.8 billion years old. And you go back to the beginning, it's the Big Bang, and say, well, where did the Big Bang come from? And then you're met with silence, right?
Well, and they're starting to rethink the Big Bang and all that stuff, you know, which is really gets them even more philosophical.
Yeah, because they've pushed up against the limits of thinking itself. And so you got people who say, well, you know, the Big Bang is the beginning of our universes, but it's not the beginning. Our universe is not the only universe. And so you have theories of endless universes that, the Einstein professor of physics at Princeton, who must be somebody who knows something or a thing or two about physics if he's got that position, named Paul Steinhardt, he wrote a book called Multiple Universes. So he thinks universes just spawn new universes. You know, the Big Bang might be a black hole in another universe. So all kinds of alternate theories. The dominant theory is, you know, they're speculative. And you, when you're doing science, you never know what's around the corner. There's speculative hypotheses. Right now, you know, the predominant paradigm is this Big Bang. And then that, on the other hand, spells entropy. You know, the whole thing's going to end up in oblivion. And so they've got such big questions, and they've gotten so far along with them that they find themselves becoming very philosophical. So some of them will say Big Bang didn't come from anywhere. It's just eternal. Well, that's sort of like saying God's eternal. So why is there something rather than nothing? Now, no matter what we do, we're never going to get to the bottom of that question. Now, that question just surrounds us with darkness. You know, there's a concealed depth to our being that we're never going to prove. You know, are we the children of God, as the Bible tells, teaches, or are we just stardust? And so when Rander says the mystery we call God, I think he's getting it right. There's this mystery of our existence, the fact that the world is there rather than not, and that we're here rather than not. And that, I think, is the ultimate subject matter of both philosophy and theology, and not just philosophy and theology, but also art. And I think it's the ultimate subject matter of anything once you dig deep enough, no matter what it is, if it's ethics, politics, art, science, religion, physics, whatever you're doing, if you dig deep enough, you find yourself digging down, you'll finally hit this sort of dark stratum, you know, this sort of unlit core, these concealed depths that you're never going to prove. And that's what interests me. Especially as I get older now. I'm 77 years old. You know, I don't know how much longer I'm going to be alive. And I look back on my life, and I had very Catholic views when I was growing up. And now I think now that those views are symbols, I think religion speaks in symbolic terms about this thing that we're, for the moment here, calling the mystery. Sort of the way, I think religion is true, but I think it's true the way literature, a novel, is true. The novels are in the fiction section of the library, right? But that doesn't mean there's no truth there, because the truth that you get from a novel is very profound. The novels are talking about life and death and childhood and old age and marriage and suffering and fidelity and infidelity and courage and hope. They talk about the deep structure of our lives, and they have powerful insights into the deep structure of our lives, which is ultimately a mystery. And they reveal a certain kind of truth about the human condition that is you can't get with a computer.
Exactly, because you have to think deeper.
You can't access it with an algorithm. You can access stuff that can be formalized with a computer, but these kinds of limit questions and questions of meaning and value, you can't formalize those problems. And so I think religion is like that. I think it's a kind of literature, it's a form of literature, the great scriptures of all the traditions. Somebody once said, if you only understand one religion, you don't understand religion. To understand religion, you have to understand the variety of religious experiences that are around the world. And every culture has some kind of religion. They don't all have what we call God, but they have some kind of space for what we call in Christian Latin religion. Religion is a Christian Latin word.
Well, can you, now that we only have about 15 minutes, I really want to make sure we get into this. I want to talk about your event. You have the notion of what the event really means. Can you explain what the event is?
Yeah, the event, this coming out of the philosopher by the name of Jacques Derrida, who died in 2004, who was the author of this thing called Deconstruction. And he had the notion that our lives are, our cultures, our languages, our cultural institutions are constructions. They have been built up in space and time, in particular places, in particular, under particular conditions. And there is always, and so because they are constructions, they are deconstructible. If they've come to be, they can pass away. If they've been built, they can be unbuilt, rebuilt, remodeled, redesigned, transformed, reinvented, etc. And so he says, what's always going on in all, any and all of these constructions is something undeconstructible, some unforeseeable future that we're straining towards. So the event is the inbreaking of something that we didn't see coming. And it could be, of course, bad news. I mean, something inbreaking could be a disaster. But once again, I don't want to keep tying everything into paradigm switches, but it's a paradigm switch. He says, when something that the present constellation, the present paradigm does not predict or foresee breaks in upon us, and changes everything. That's the event. And he says, but the event is simmering within things. So events are coming. They are to come. They're always they belong to our horizon of expectation. But there are also possibilities that are stirring within things right now, which is why you can say, well, an event is not what happens; it's what's going on in what happens. And so there's always, which is a way of saying, there's always something promised in our institutions, in our languages, in our practices, in our culture. Our cultures, the cultural forms of life are made restless from within by a promise, by a hope, by an expectation, which is the coming of the event. And then so he says, the great changes that occur are the result of the event, and they produce, he didn't use this language, but they produce paradigm switches. They rearrange, they transform everything.
So it's something that creates radical shifts in thinking and action and the way people behave. But can you give us an example of what would be an event?
Well, in the history of science, you see it in the big shifts that occur in the history of science, in Copernicus and in Einstein. The easiest examples, I think, are in the history of art, because art is so mutable. You know, it's got such a rich history, and it's subject to sudden shifts. And so, you think of taking a urinal, signing it, putting it on a platform or a pedestal, and declaring it a work of art.
Oh, you're talking modern art.
So you,
some of us never really got into that event, but go ahead.
Oh, it's hard to get into it because it's, you know, it's a paradigm shift. Or Picasso, when Picasso, his first cubist paintings. The art world is just scratching their head. What is this art? What is it? So
It's supposed to be like rap music in the music industry, or even rock and roll itself back in the day when that hit the scene.
Yeah, the history of art in general is ripe with examples of events. But then you can have it, you can have it anywhere. You can have it in science, you can have it in politics, you can have it in religion. When Luther created a paradigm shift that changed the history of Christianity. It's an interesting way to think about things. Instead of dividing the world up into the arts and the sciences, you say, well, there's a more interesting shift there, and that is everybody in the arts or the sciences, or in ordinary life even, operates under sort of reigning, prevailing assumptions, current paradigms, which are liable to interruption and something inbreaking. And that crosses the line between the humanities and the sciences. And so you have a way of thinking about the humanities and the sciences together. Namely, we're all in this together. We all operate under what, in physics, they call it the standard model. We operate under prevailing paradigms. If we didn't have those prevailing paradigms, life would be chaos. You need prevailing paradigms. And when they're challenged, you have to be a little bit, you have to resist the challenge, because otherwise, if paradigms fall too easily, it'll be chaos. But when you run into something genuinely inbreaking, you don't know whether it's genuinely inbreaking or if it's just crazy. It could be just crazy, and it's not going to change anything, because
it passes over.
Yeah, it just blows away. It's not some irregularity deep in the system. It's just a chance odd phenomenon.
Well, you say doubt is divine.
Yeah. See, orthodox theological tradition tries to drive doubt out. It wants to make faith certain. Well, if faith is certain, then faith is not faith. It's certain. There's nothing to worry about.
It's servitude almost, isn't it? It's no critical thinking. You haven't even evolved your mental thing to understand it.
Yeah. And you haven't taken any responsibility for it. So faith is really faith when you're not so sure, but you're going to put your mouth where your money where your mouth is, and you're going to put yourself in harm's way for something that you truly believe in, and knowing that there's no guarantees here. And I think that's true of a lot of things. It's not just true of faith, but doubt is ingredient in faith. Otherwise, faith is not faith. It's just self-assurance. The same thing's true of hope. Hope is the only hope when things are beginning to look hopeless. Otherwise, it's just a good bet. And you really see this in the New Testament. Love is love, not when you love people who love you back, but when you love your enemies. When you love those who are not so lovable.
How do you do that? How do you love someone who is absolutely deplorable? And how do you act on that?
Yeah, how indeed?
let's talk about someone who's horrible to children, a pedophile of some sort, and uses them up and throws them away. How do you love that person? I'm trying to understand that. That's something I'm grappling with. I'm trying not to have hatred for a whole group of people.
Right. Yeah. Well, we are like that. I think you're not alone. Loving someone doesn't mean not restraining them from doing harm. In fact, it would be a sign of love for them to restrain them from doing harm, because in doing harm to others is doing harm to themselves.
Absolutely.
But I think all of these, all of the practices that matter most to us are practices that are slightly mad. They have a kind of madness or divine madness to them. That's what I like about religion. I do think religion, there are a lot of problems with religion, and its authoritarianism, and its recalcitrance to change, its resistance to change. A lot of things are wrong with religion. Above all, with authoritarianism. But religion is a home for this model of this way to be that, when it's true to itself, is genuinely different and genuinely challenging, because it asks us to do these things that seem impossible and beyond us, but it's calling us to do those things. So it's asking us to have a faith that moves mountains, and to hope against hope, and to love those who to persecute you. The way Derrida once put it is, he talked about the possibility of the impossible. Possibility of the impossible. Now, I actually think that that is the way the word God functions. I think the name of God is the name for a limit condition. You know, in other languages, in other cultures, in other worlds, in other times, it may be different. But in the world that we've inherited from the Greeks and the Bible, the name of God is the name of the possibility of the impossible. So the name of God is the name of a hope and an expectation that all things can be made new, that things can be transformed in ways that we don't think are possible anymore. So I don't think the name of God is the name of a being. I think it's the name of a hope, an expectation, a dream, in the best sense of a dream, the way Martin Luther King had a dream, not illusionary, but dreaming of something we want to happen. But we can't see it happening. It seems impossible. And when you look in the scriptures, you'll see that God is often associated with that. The scriptures say things like, well, like when Mary, you and the angel announces to Mary that she's with child, she says, how is that possible? And he says, with God all things, the angel says, with God all things are possible. I think that's what is ultimately going on in the name of God, that it's a way that the mystery we call God is a way to name the possibility of the impossible, of a future that we can hardly imagine. Eye has not seen or ear heard what is laid up for us. So it's a way of dreaming, hoping, not in some aimless way, but a way of, in such a way as to engage us in action. So it seizes us. People who respond to this name, who respond to what's going on in this name, who are inspired by the religious traditions, are people of action. You know, they do crazy things. They go work in the poorest neighborhoods, poorest and most dangerous neighborhoods in North America to help people who need doctors or who need help, who are desperately poor or need teachers or who need whatever they need. So they do things that are have a kind of madness about them, kind of divine madness. Philosophers tend to say more rational things than that, you know, which is good. I mean, I'm not against reason. You know? I'm not trying to undermine reason. Reason and faith belong together for me. Reason always involves a certain kind of faith, and faith better have a pretty good reason, or it's, you know, it's dangerous. But I do think this notion of the possibility of the impossible. The impossible signifies a kind of limit state, and the possibility of that impossible thing. I think that's actually what's going on in the name of God. It's not the name of a being who's going to do this for us, or who's going to steer this tsunami away from the shore so that it doesn't destroy lives and property. It's not going to cure cancer. It's not going to help Philadelphia sports teams win the Super Bowl. It's not. God doesn't work like that. I think the name of God is a name for something deep in the human heart. And it's not simply subjective. I think it has to do with the real world, with what the real world is demanding of us, the demands it puts upon us in which we respond. to which we have to respond. So I think religion is a powerful with a weak power, a powerful way we have of imagining our condition in the face of an insurmountable mystery.
Since we don't have very much time, do you mind using my last question that I have for you here as something for Patreons only? We have, I wanted to ask you how, with all the chaos that's everywhere, how people and leaders can deal with it. Can we do that for my Patreons only and close this out and have you tell us where people can find more about you and how to get your work?
Well, that's easy enough. I mean, just go on Amazon and you'll see my just key me in and you'll see all my books. The one we're talking about right now is called The Weakness of God. And that's a kind of an academic book. There's another one that is written for a non-academic audience. That's better, and that's just simply called On Religion.
Okay, right? Excellent.
And it's written by it's a Routledge book.
I love talking to you. I can't tell you how much I love talking to you. So thank you so much for coming and talking to people. And I hope let's stick around and do one more question.